Barnsley, Vera One. So first of all, Tom, could I ask you about your background? You know, whereabouts you were born and brought out.
Yes.
And things like your education and family.
Right. The eldest son of a large family of eight, two brothers, five sisters. Born in the Black Country, Wensbury. Went to the local church school and then to the local high school, Wensbury Boys High School, which basically was a very poor area, Black Country, boys who'd won scholarships to what was the first high school in the area serving four or five Black Country towns. Therefore, one saw a background of deprivation. I influenced, I suppose, at school towards socialism and seeing it firsthand in the depression of the 30s, the early 30s at school, the consequences of unemployment and deprivation. I suppose this had some influence on my attitude to international war and peace, and it coincided with a great activity of the Peace Pledge Union, of which I became a member and an active participant in the mid-30s, just on leaving school. I think also as a family background of Church of England, I had also a strong orientation towards Christianity, albeit not in the traditional formal Church of England liturgy, but much more on the teachings of Christ, which I did and still believe are fundamentally one of pacifism. So this background led me, particularly during the build-up in the late 30s, towards a feeling that there was a great danger that a second war was imminent. And looking back at the writings of Siegfried Sassoon, Rupert Brooke, I could see that a choice probably had to be made again. And while I think most socialists and pacifists at that time would say that the evil of dictatorship, Hitler or Mussolini, and the potency of Mussolini, of course, was his terrible treatment of the conquest of Ethiopia, where gas was used, and where the United Nations seemed incapable or unwilling to take any action. This, you may think, should have led one towards a realization that force must be met by force. And I suppose that was probably the nearest time one got to some doubt as to whether turning the other cheek was going to do the job. Nevertheless, it did seem to me that it was international politics very strongly. And I think the general mood in the country at that time, as we know, probably epitomised by the much now abused Neville Chamberlain, did feel that negotiation was better than open warfare. What we didn't know, and I think what many pacifists, including myself, we've had a greater battle of conscience. Had we now of the known of the personal anti-Jewish Holocaust which was going on, because I suspect in our wildest dreams we didn't realise that that could go on in any society. We'd, I think, become used to the, not used to, but we'd taken aboard the terrible 1914-18, what still seems, totally needless loss of life in the trenches. And I suppose it was that that we were revolting against, plus the fact that after all these millions of deaths, that the politicians still had to settle down after the war, and with the Versailles Treaty we led from one terrible situation building up to another one. So it was that, making a quasi-political but basically a religious belief, that led me to register as a conscientious objector in 1938 or maybe 39.
What about your family? You know, were they pacifists?
No. In fact, it was, I think, by this time my mother, of course, had died, and my father had married again. I think it was a shock to him, because he had been in the First World War as an able seaman and had served a long time in the North Atlantic. But I think he knew that what war was, and he knew and wasn't in the slightest impressed with the jingoistic rally round the cause. He said that your ideas of right and wrong in this respect are very clear cut at 20. Me nearer 45, 50. You may have different and second thoughts. However, I respect your right to make that decision, and I support you. And that was very good, because he did get, as my family did, a lot of brickbats, a tremendous lot of brickbats. In fact, I think it's probably the families of pacifists and conscientious objectors who had more difficulty than the young men themselves. So, there were four or five of us at school who had similar views and registered as conscientious objectors. At least five, two of whom I know, having registered as conscientious objectors, and as the war developed, changed their minds and joined the forces. Two others I know went on to the land. And there was at least one other who was a unilateralist, or what was the word we used in those days?
The sort of absolutist.
Absolutist, that's right. Mm. Absolutist. And he, I think, had a very tough time, but I lost track with him. Anyway, my tribunal gave me, on religious grounds, a conditional exemption, provided I stayed in my present job, which had some connotation of national importance, as a trainee chartered accountant. I think they saw that administratively they were going. And I annoyed the judge by saying that I thanked him for that, but told him it was unacceptable. And because I had intended anyway to do medical relief work and join the Red Cross or some appropriate body. And of course he said, well, that's all right, but why don't you join the RAMC? And I said, well, I can understand that, and I have no objection at all, except that I do think I should be joining the system. So anyway, he said, well, providing the medical relief work is accepted, I will extend this as a second condition. So it was then I looked round and saw the Friends Ambulance Unit, who I knew several of the Cadburys in Birmingham, whom I always respected but had no great close association with. And on writing to Paul Cadbury, he, I think, said, well, yes, if this is what you'd like to do, I think you could do useful work. And clearly, although you're not a member of the Society of Friends, you have many of their ideals in mind. And on that basis, in January 1940, I joined the training camp at Bourneville in Birmingham.
Before I ask you about that, could we go back to the tribunal?
Yes.
And the statement. I understand you had to prepare a statement.
Yes.
Can you remember how you explained your pacifism? Was it in Christian terms, or did you bring in other things?
I brought in a abhorrence of war in its own right. What I regarded as the total failure of the 1418 war, that in the end one had to negotiate, and while holding no truck at all for the dictators, it seemed to me that we hadn't got to the situation where we tried. But fundamentally it was religious belief, which my pacifism still is, that the highest aspiration of right or wrong or morality, as I see it, is the life of Christ. And I say the life of Christ and his teachings without ascribing the traditional Church of England or Roman Catholic beliefs that this was God incarnate. It is very much the highest thing that mere mortals can aspire to, in my view, is the life of Christ. And we failed miserably, but that was the aspiration. And I think it was on those grounds that it was accepted as a conscientious religious belief.
Is there anything in the life of Christ that you could sort of give as an example?
Well, I think fundamentally the idea that you convert people by example, and that you can't really do anything to anyone else that you wouldn't be done to yourself, that the supreme feeling of truth is sacrifice, and that Christ seemed to epitomize all those feelings finally with a belief that by a simple renunciation he could have spared himself the crucifixion. And I suppose that comes out time and time in the Bible. The whole essence of, it seems to me, of the New Testament, i.e. the life of Christ, is so very different from the Old Testament, which is an eye for an eye, and Christ, of course, in the New Testament, was turn the other cheek. So it was very much the New Testament and not the traditional view of the Church, although I think the Church did agonise over its necessary support, and of course quite sensibly said that whatever people's decision and reasons, we have to minister to them, and of course I'm sure the chaplains did a superb job in the war. So that was really basically the situation where I arrived, bearing in mind that at 20 one is still pretty immature and one's views, idealistic or otherwise, are pretty black and white.
Did you have any sort of worry at the time, you know, as this 20-year-old, that perhaps you were compromising with the military machine by doing medical work. You know, did it strike you as a dilemma at that time?
No, it didn't me. It didn't strike me as that. Having made my protest and having worked through the Peace Pledge Union to avoid the situation, and having made, as I say, my personal protest, it seemed to me that then we had got to each do what he thought to relieve the consequences of what was about to happen. So having once decided that I could do, quite clear conscience, in fact eager to do, I had no qualms about this being a political gesture or act to complete the absolutist picture or anything like that. I admired those people who did, but it wasn't for me at all. And that's why the work in the FAU was so readily acceptable to me.
It seems that you were eager to do something.
Yes.
In the war context.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And I suppose this is fundamentally why I was not prepared to stay in the work of a clerical nature, which the judge had said I should. Now, I suppose as a 20-year-old looking back, this was to demonstrate two things. One, that one wanted to help. But also, probably less creditable, it was to try and prove that, yes, put me in any dangerous situation, and the more dangerous, the better. And I think this is why one or two of my colleagues from old school days, or at least one of them, went on a minesweeper. And that had clearly crossed my mind too. So, it was to do something, as you say.
Were you frightened at all of being labelled a coward?
I think this went through everyone's mind. One was sensitive to it. And I think, yes, I think if one's honest, one was embarrassed, and very much embarrassed for one's family. And there's no doubt in my experience that the ladies were the most militant. I'd never got the actual white feather, but I did have several instances where they made very clear what they thought of my position. But that was more for embarrassment of my family rather than myself.
Was it a relief to get into an organisation like the FAU?
Yes, yes. I think if you're a very small minority in any society or group, you clearly congregate and look for mutual support on people of like minds. And I suppose this is so in any type of society. So if people went on the land, they were in a community of pacifists on the land. If they went into medical work, such as the FAU, and there were many pacifists in the Red Cross who had a like mind, there were many people in the RAMC that one later came across who had no strong political view or religious view, but felt that their contribution was healing rather than taking the other sort of action. So really that was the background, and arriving at a very big cross-sector of society in the FAU was a great education in itself. I'd come from a pretty lowly background, as I say, in the black country. There were the I suppose, a substantial proportion were university undergraduates. There were the sons of bishops and there were sons of coal miners. And the one thing they had in common was this pacifism, and by definition in the FAU, largely religious pacifism. Not entirely, but I suspect it, but largely. So it was both a relief and a help.
And your training, you know, what was your initial training?
Well, we all had to take the St. John's Ambulance and, certificate. So we were taught by doctors and nurses over a 6 or 8 week course to give us basic medically orderly training. Thereafter, the policy was to send us to military hospitals all over the country. At that time, there were not many casualties. In fact, there were no casualties. and it was really the services, sickness, etc. This is, of course, before Dunkirk. But there the training was very much on what was expected, broken limbs and great emphasis on the expectation that it was going to be like the First World War, I think. This was very useful because it taught us the use of medicines, setting fractures, giving injections, and of course keeping very fit, because it was again expected, I think, repetition of the First World War, that you're going to be dashing and getting people out of the trenches or etc. Well, after that, I moved to London, and this of course coincided, the shock to everyone was the first bombs that fell on London. And I was at the going towards the Mile End Hospital when the first bomb fell on London. It fell between Hackney and Bethnal Green. And of course everyone seeing these places, this was August 40, wasn't it? Seeing these airplanes thought they were manoeuvres until the first bomb did start. And then, of course, it was all hell let loose for, well, right through the next 6 to 9 months, I suppose. And we saw casualties then in the hospitals in that East End. This is before the West End had received anything. For that 6 month period, at the East End hospitals, and at that time I was based, I left the Hackney Hospital and went to the London Hospital. And London had some terrible direct hits with great casualties both to nurses as well as patients. And it was, that was the real initiation into death and destruction. And of course, one was very pleased to be able to help. At the time there were, I suppose, a couple of hundred of us in London, and this was at the inception. I think the FAU must take a lot of credit for the influence it had on the London County Council, as it was then, I suppose, in organising the air raid shelters of Tubes, and the Tubes where they used to flock down every night, and the rest centres, which were converted schools and parish halls after the children had been evacuated. In fact, relief, which was totally unknown in the First World War and therefore had not been planned for in any way. So that was both a useful training and a very positive feel that, right, this is now the civilian population. And I think, strangely enough, one, at least I felt that it was the involvement of that civilian population which tempered and in some ways changed the view of the average civilian towards the pacifist. who recognised that it wasn't a conscience and it wasn't a coward. It was some other person who was quite prepared to go dashing in the streets and collecting and digging in the rubble and bringing people out. And therefore, the idea of these people refused to fight, but were doing this, at least proved that they weren't conscience cowards. And I think from then on, one, at least certainly I got the feeling, that whether working with the military direct, as we did later, or with the authorities, that we were looked upon and respected as somebody who had personal views but who were getting on with the job of trying to sort out the mess.
Did it alter your attitude in any way towards the Germans who were doing this to people, did you find? Did you, you know, become partisan in any way?
No. In fact, if anything, it confirmed my view. I knew what was happening to London, and it didn't need much imagination to know that this was happening to Hamburg, Bremen, at the same time. So it really, in that sense, said, well, this is just war of attrition. I agree, at that stage, people looked upon it, or at least I think pacifists looked upon it as a big political confrontation of superpowers that was going along the lines of the 1418 war, with the major exception that civilian populations were involved in this war. None of us knew at that time what was going on in the concentration camps. And I think this may have changed one's view of the possibility of overcoming bad with good. And had we known then, I'm not sure that we should have held our pacifist views as strongly as we did at that time.